Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and I want to turn today to the declining fortunes of the Harold Wilson government. You can sort of divide Wilson's time in office from 1964 when he won a narrow majority to 1970 when he's defeated by Ted Heath. There's another election in 66, into sort of kind of waves of sort of optimism, not quite the same sort of euphoria that one saw in 1997 when Labour was elected. A lot of the euphoria was more manufactured than you think. The pictures of Tony Blair outside Downing Street with kind of throngs of people cheering and saying, hooray, you've liberated from Margaret Thatcher. Most of those people apparently were Labour, the families and friends of Labour Party staffers. So, but there was in 1997 a genuine kind of relief that the Tories had been defeated. The social brutalities of Thatcherism notwithstanding, the Tory government simply got into a place of kind of on sort of necrotic kind of corruption, and MPs being paid to answer questions from Mohammed Al-Fayed and things like that, stuff with which now, compared to the kind of stratospheric levels of British corruption, seems sort of relatively benign and playground. But there you go. But anyway, Wilson in 64 makes much of his of the Conservative Party's out of touch nature, the kind of aristocratic backgrounds of the likes of Harold Macmillan and Alec Douglas Hume, presenting himself as kind of far more working class and down to earth, which in fact actually Wilson wasn't. Wilson was a kind of solid member of the British middle classes, and had was an economist, and had had quite a good career during the war as a civil servant, and was far from being the kind of the plebeian character that he sort of pretended to be. Famously a pipe smoker and a beer drinker, and much of this is kind of a part of his performance. But there was a sense in Britain in the early 1960s of egalitarianism. You know, there's a kind of a brief moment in the early 60s with sort of playwrights like John Osborne and the rise of working class actors, and you know, Sean Connery and Michael Caine and people like that, and obviously the things like the Beatles, and the idea that kind of the working classes, and particularly the north of England, was a place of kind of cultural vibrancy and agency, something that's kind of rarely acknowledged, and that this kind of egalitarianism, which would be paired with a sort of a kind of tech utopianism. This was the age of kind of atomic power and the, you know, the space race and things like that, and this would power a new modern Britain into the last part of the 20th century and perhaps even into the 21st. Wilson talked about this idea of kind of Britain, the white heat of technology transforming Britain. There is a Ministry of Technology that's established, and you have things during Wilson's era like kind of the Post Office Tower, and the development of Concord, though, you know, Concord's development overlaps various kind of Labour and Tory governments. But there was a belief that kind of science was Britain's future, which is, you know, fair to say that it is, in some ways it is Britain's future. Britain is a kind of even at its lowest points in the 20th century a science and technology leader in almost every field. But by the end of the kind of the Wilson administration, many of these hopes had not been realised, and there is a kind of almost like a profound sense of disappointment in what Wilson had done and not done. And the second part of the Wilson story, I mean, obviously Wilson comes back in 1974 briefly until 76, in a very kind of much diminished character. But the second part of the first period of Harold Wilson's government is, you know, the period 68 to 70, which is a period of decline, and that's what we're going to look at today in Kenneth O. Morgan's amazing book, The People's Peace. If you're looking for a book about post-war Britain, get this book, The People's Peace. It's kind of one of those classics of the genre. Anyway, Kenneth O. Morgan writes, in the aftermath of the devaluation of the pound, the Labour government of Harold Wilson entered upon a grim period of deflation and austerity. In some ways, it resembled the phase of retrenchment that followed the departure of Hugh Dalton in November 1947, when Sir Stafford Cripps imposed a stern and Spartan regime of rationing and controls. Okay, let's sort of unpack that a little bit. The devaluation. Britain was becoming significantly less economically competitive in the 1960s. Its large overseas presence, its state sector, its welfare state, and would perhaps have been sustainable, or more sustainable, had it not been for Britain's culture of short-termism and industrial kind of low levels of reinvestment. And its gradual increasing number of days lost to strike action. Now, we'll come on to strike action in a little bit. And much of what happens in the 1970s within industrial disputes could perhaps have been prevented by Wilson in 68 and 69. But we should explore that. So Britain is finding it harder and harder in the 60s to pay its own bills and to pay its own way, and becoming less and less of an attractive place for people to overseas companies to want to invest. The currency controls that were removed in the late 1940s mean that there is the possibility of capital flight from Great Britain. This is one of the things that kind of ends Britain's great power status. Wilson puts off a devaluation of the pound, which was his only kind of route out of his problems. He puts it off three times, then finally it becomes unavoidable. Wilson has to devalue, and has to devalue in a kind of the most brutal ways in 1967. The devaluation in 1967 meant that kind of an awful lot of the spending plans that Wilson had, and an awful lot of the the energy and the ambition of the Wilson government is swept away. And so what you have between 68 and 70 is a period of austerity. And periods of austerity under Labour governments in Britain are always particularly resented by Labour Party members, by ordinary people who assume that the kind of the economic cruelties inflicted on the British people are, that's really the job of the Tories. And it kind of is, but Labour Party politicians wanting to present themselves as kind of having economic credentials and prudency and all the sorts of stuff that their newspaper critics admire, often have to grab and implement austerity itself. The economic leader this time was a very different personality. Roy Jenkins, the son of a South Wales miners agent who had progressed through Balliol and being Attlee's private secretary to create a public image of confidence, competence and sociability. Jenkins, indeed, in many ways, seemed an unlikely spokesman for what he promised as 2 hard years of slog. In time, his image of fastidious superiority and alleged taste for fine claret became the butt of journalists and clubland wits. He ended up as Chancellor of Oxford University, but Jenkins was also a tough operator who had been a striking success at that traditional graveyard of reputations, the Home Office, where his liberal policies and attack on censorship and repression chimed with the prevailing tolerant mood. He had also deepened his knowledge of political affairs through writing some notable works on political history, including the studies of Charles Dilke, Asquith, and the crisis between the Liberal government and the House of Lords in 1909 to 1911. Indeed, the temperamental affinity between the ex-Gaitskellite Labour right and the Asquithian Liberals of a former era was noted. Roy Jenkins, in his kind of last act in his sort of political life, formed in the early 1980s, along with Shirley Williams, the SDP, the Social Democratic Party. And this was essentially kind of like a right offshoot of the Labour Party, which had then moved to the left under Michael Foote. And it began with kind of wild popularity. Most British people were not radical supporters in the early 1980s of Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher's government, in fact, or Margaret Thatcher by 1983, before the Falklands conflict, was one of the most unpopular British prime ministers that the country had ever had. However, the Labour Party under Michael Foote also struggled to be electorally successful, and the belief that Jenkins had, who's kind of on the right of the Labour Party and had an affinity with kind of the Liberals, was that there's a kind of like a division of the Labour vote would ultimately defeat the left of the Labour Party. This is essentially a tried and tested strategy that was recycled during the Corbyn era. Roy Jenkins was responsible in many ways for Margaret Thatcher's victory in 1983. Above all, Jenkins was a gifted and skillful economist, even though, surprisingly, he had not served in the Cabinet Economic Committee prior to becoming Chancellor in late 1967. As custodian of the Treasury over the next few years, admittedly through a tough and perhaps needlessly severe regime of retrenchment, Jenkins boosted his reputation as a major public figure in a way highly unusual in the chequered history of British economic policy since the war. He was one of those prime ministers we never had. There was every suggestion that Jenkins should probably have succeeded Wilson, but it was not to be.
His dominance at the Treasury coincided with a major remodelling of the administration. This came at a time when Wilson's own reputation was taking a battering in the media, especially the press. The catalyst was the final acceptance of George Brown's resignation, so often offered as and so frequently rejected, in March 1968. George Brown was this kind of rather anarchic, heavy-drinking Labour cabinet minister who seemed to sort of cause anarchy wherever he went and was constantly at odds with Wilson, desperate to succeed him, and yet kind of always unlikely to. The casus belli was the decision by Wilson, Jenkins and Peter Shaw to close the London stock market without consulting Brown. This relieved Wilson of an impulsive and difficult, if in some ways inspirational, minister. His successor at the Foreign Office was Michael Stewart, who had been there before. Meanwhile, James Callaghan at the Home Office began to repair a reputation somewhat dented by his difficult 3 years as Chancellor, but much of the energy of the government clearly lay elsewhere. Anthony Crossland, another ex-Gateskellite on the right of the party, became the Secretary of State in charge of trade and industry and was in clear command of economic matters in partnership with Roy Jenkins. It marked, among other things, the final triumph of the Treasury over the concept of any Department of Economic Affairs. The Department of Economic Affairs was an innovation set up by Wilson in 1964 after the Wilson victory. And it was a poorly thought through institution. It sort of didn't so much take powers from the Treasury as kind of duplicated its role. The Treasury always being of the view that it kind of directed fiscal and monetary policy and thus shaped the nature of the economy. The Department of Economic Affairs kind of dies on the vine. It's starved out initially, and there are stories of it being assigned kind of essentially broom cupboards in government ministries and being underfunded and marginalised, as is often the way in Whitehall when a minister's innovation does not meet with civil service approval. Another thing worth briefly depacking here, or unpacking, is this term Gateskellite, what it means. And it was a reference to Hugh Gateskell, who had was on the right of the Labour Party, who was one of Labour's last chancellors before the defeat of the first Labour government, first post-war Labour government in 1951, and who had always kind of clashed with the left, particularly with Nye Bevan, the founding figure of the NHS. The right of the Labour Party is probably really called the shots in the Labour Party for most of the party's history. It is a party. It is a kind of like a tendency in the party that that doesn't dismiss the value of things like a welfare state, but is more likely to veer towards austerity when required, when required is a very debatable concept, but more likely veer towards issues of positions on national security, NATO, of Atlanticism, and synchronising foreign policy with the United States of America than figures like Nye Bevan, later on Michael Foot, Tony Benn, those sorts of individuals. They were in some ways the kind of the heyday of that tendency in the party was during the Second World War and the early Cold War, when Labour could establish itself essentially as a kind of a party of state, as a party that could be trusted with things like national security. And I say, by the way, trusted by the established elites in Great Britain, who almost immediately, almost from kind of Ramsay MacDonald's government onwards, had felt that he had kind of successfully tamed the Labour Party, which is a fair comment, really. So Gaitskellites were those on the right of the Labour Party who followed Hugh Gaitskell. Hugh Gaitskell died in 1963. Many conspiracy theories swirl around this, but died really of natural causes, and would have no doubt been a future British Prime Minister had he lived. The Gaitskellite tendency was kind of, it had its ultimate expression under Anthony Crossland, who wrote a book called The Future of Socialism, and that became almost like a blueprint of New Labour in the 1990s. So, to balance these right-wing advances, in typical careful Wilsonian manner, two old Bevanites also progressed in notable fashion. Richard Crossman became Secretary of State in charge of social services, while Mrs. Barbara Castle, the only woman cabinet minister, made spectacular rise as Secretary for Employment and Productivity in charge of key sensitive negotiations with the TUC, the Trades Union Congress, of which we'll talk about more, on incomes policy. In the other changes, Edward Short went to Education and George Thomas to the Welsh Office. Cledwyn Hughes went to Agriculture and Patrick Gordon Walker left the government altogether. Significantly, Dennis Healey, the Minister of Defence and one of the clear ministerial successors since 1964, was not promoted. But he had publicly disagreed with the Prime Minister both over cuts in defence expenditure and over arms sales to South Africa, which Healey at that time supported. Healey was that part of the Labour tradition that was hawkish, that viewed what remained of the British Empire and Britain's kind of overseas imperial role as still serving some important good. It's this weird idea that people have about the post-war Labour Party, that it was somehow not an imperialist party. The wealth, much of the kind of wealth invested in Britain as a result of the welfare state came from Britain's control of Malayan rubber, and in the 1960s, as Defence Secretary, Healey was very keen on waging war from Borneo into Indonesia. So in internal party terms, with men like Peter Shaw moving up in the administration, the government shifted marginally to the left with these changes. So far as these factors had any meaning in the period of incessant financial crisis in which the government operated. But the dominant feature of all was probably the continuing pressure on Wilson's personal standing, with failure on the economy, Europe and Rhodesia sagging support in the polls, and a mood of almost psychotic apprehension throughout the party and the administration. So again, let's unpack a couple of things there. So obviously we know that there's been this kind of mounting economic crisis in Britain from the 1960s onwards. There is this post-war consumer boom, which isn't so much a product of Britain's expanding economy, but an expanding world economy. Led by America in the 1950s and 1960s, that everyone kind of benefits from, or at least most of the first world nations do. And this is starting to slow down by the late 1960s. Many of Britain's kind of structural problems are still there. On the subject of Europe, well, the British had the opportunity in the late 1940s to join the European Coal and Steel Pact, and failed to do so. So it was a Labour government that rejected this. The British applied several times to join the European Economic Community. Under Macmillan, they were rejected, and also under Wilson. De Gaulle took kind of great and perverse delight in saying no to Great Britain, not wanting an Anglophone voice and British power within the community. The British...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Had become pretty convinced by the mid-1960s that this was essential for, or various British governments, shall we say, and civil servants and opinion formers had become pretty convinced by the mid-1960s that this was essential for their economic survival as the last remnants of the empire drifted away and Britain's world role and world power went into steep decline. And yet it took until Ted Heath in 1973, a further 5 years later, for Britain to gain admission. And the question of Rhodesia, once again, if you go back in this podcast to listen to the interview I had with James McManus, that's all the way back in August, so it's quite a few episodes ago, August last year. You'll hear an interview and a much longer conversation about Britain's role and in Rhodesia and the attempts by Britain to give Rhodesia independence, the defiance by the white minority colonists there. And the war that follows with the majority black population, a war which is ultimately resolved in the late 1970s with the victory of Robert Mugabe. So anyway, listen to the interview with James McManus. It's a particularly good one. In this new ascendant position, Jenkins began to impose restrictions of a kind not experienced since the grim days of the Korean War. Following a rise in bank rate, the interest rate, to 8% at the end of 1967, Jenkins' budget of March 1968 rained blows on the consumer and the industry alike. In all, $923 million would be taken out of the economy in a full financial year, which doesn't sound like a lot now, but it certainly was then, including $163 million from purchase tax in a full, and $152 million from select employment tax, and higher duties on motor licences, petrol, cigarettes, betting and drink, the British population's favourite things. There would also be an exceptional one-year levy on unearned incomes. Now that's interesting. This is the sort of thing that is an anathema to British governments now, the taxing of wealth. But in the mid-1960s, there is a sense that taxing wealth is the right thing to do, and it's also makes a sensible thing to do. Total priority was to be given to the balance of payments. Jenkins stated that stating it as his objective, that a balance of $500 million would be achieved as soon as possible to take advantage of the recent devaluation of the pound. There were commentators who praised the draconian methods he was proposing in order to achieve this object. Peter Jay in the Times declared, that perhaps misplaced euphoria, that the Chancellor had risen fully and magnificently to the occasion. Others soberly noted that the cost of living would probably rise by 1 shilling in the pound, and that this depressing effect on domestic demand would mean an end to the promises that Labour could in any way expand the nation's economic growth. So here is the problem. Because of Britain's uncompetitive industries, because Britain becomes a net importer, Britain's balance of payments, the amount of money coming into the country versus the amount of money going out of the country is negative. So Britain is more money is going overseas than is being brought in through exports. And so Jenkins' strategy is austerity, to simply suck cash out of the economy, which isn't a particularly kind of elegant strategy. But it certainly slows down consumer demand. It doesn't do anything to deal with the long-term effects of sluggish industries. And here you kind of reach an economic crossroads where you get two alternative visions, which over the next 20 years compete with one another, the latter of the two prevailing, the first being the Tony Benn vision of state intervention to help struggling industries and at all costs to maintain jobs. Ben, who actually was a believer in innovation, he loved kind of gadgets and technology and Britain's kind of makers and saw that as a fundamentally good thing, thought that the Labour commitment to full employment was a kind of a sacred pledge that should not be broken. And even if that meant you subsidise uncompetitive industries, well, so be it. It kind of doesn't really matter how British workers get fed, as long as they do. And I actually don't think that Tony Benn was really proposing allowing industry to be inefficient. He thought by subsidising it and by the government investing in industry, you actually make it better and more efficient. Controversial argument, and sort of never actually really tried. The vision that prevails from 1979 onwards is Margaret Thatcher's of allowing markets to sweep away businesses that are not competitive and allowing businesses that are competitive to prevail. This is in some ways at odds with the other part of kind of Thatcher's ethos and worldview, which is about flying the flag for Britain, about patriotism, economic liberalism that simply allows markets to operate as they in theory do. And very often we're not even talking about the operation of markets, we're talking about kind of concentrations of capital doing what they want, which is just not the same thing. These conditions very rarely create the outcomes that nationalists and patriots want. And certainly by the mid-1980s, the revival of British industry that Margaret Thatcher had hoped for certainly hasn't happened. In fact, it could easily be argued that she sort of finishes it off. And that post-Thatcherist world is a kind of a deindustrialised one. Certainly, British manufacturing doesn't come back as a result of Thatcherism in the 1980s. The Jenkins' stern regimen continued. Indirect taxes were raised by 10% through the regulator, and the higher purchase controls were tightened still further. Currency restrictions largely abolished foreign holidays for sections of the population, so preventing people from taking money out of the country, and higher purchase controls, obviously, were the controls on consumer credit. He was slowing down spending and making sure that pounds stayed in Britain. At the end of the year, the benefits alleged to accrue from devaluation still had not materialised. Indeed, there was a renewed talk that autumn of a further balance of payments crisis. A government committee, which featured Wilson, Jenkins, Crossland, Shaw and Castle, prepared Plan Brutus, a contingency scheme for yet another devaluation, accompanied by by import and exchange controls and further massive deflation. So more and more austerity. there was still no real sign of a restructuring of the economy, and the diversion of resources from private consumption to exports and industrial investment was still not apparent. The capital account showed signs of improvement, but with a continued rise in the import bill, the visible trade balance continued to deteriorate. Economists confidently forecast another year of total economic stagnation in 1969. In some ways, it could be argued that all what was happening here with austerity and the measures that Jenkin was imposing on Britain is that, you know, Britain is being revealed to be a poorer country than was previously thought. You know, essentially an economic truth is being revealed. But that in itself doesn't really win elections. People don't want economic truths. They want abundance and good times and that sort of thing. But it certainly is an indicator of Britain's diminishing circumstances in the 1960s. The thing that we will see, and I'll do this on the next of these podcasts, it's probably worth doing a two-parter, is that economic crisis and stagnation would be the catalyst to labour disputes. And throughout the last part of Wilson's administration and into Heath and then Wilson's second administration and then Callaghan, the country's fundamental problem, as was seen by the tabloid press and the broadsheet press, was that of industrial relations. And one could argue that Margaret Thatcher's entire mandate in the 1980s was to break the power of Britain's trade unions and to fundamentally change the way that Britain's labour force functioned. In this, she was successful, but in very little else. But anyway, I'm going to finish there. Thanks everyone for listening, and thanks everyone. I had some really, really good feedback, some really, really positive feedback from last week's podcast. Ruffled some feathers, as inevitably it was going to, but you can't hope in life to go around pleasing everybody, can you? So thanks for everyone's support, and there'll be an incredible podcast coming next week. I am interviewing the brilliant academic Lauren LeSabe Shepherd from the University of New Orleans, who has a new book about the campus culture wars in America during the 1960s, looking at the ascendancy, not of the radical student movement, but of their nemesis, the growth of campus conservatism, and its impact on the development of politics in America for decades afterwards. So check that out. Anyway, all the best. Thanks very much, everyone, and goodbye.